Eva, do you have access to a microphone over there?
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for your all very interesting commentaries. And the first, I would like to give the floor to Matt, if you want to respond and if you want to comment on some of the panelists.
Thank you. I mean, let me offer some brief comments. I thought that those were really interesting comments from everybody. That I think raised some interesting questions, you know, for Sweden and for how you do aid. And I think, as you say, this is an opportunistic time to be asking those questions. I think that it's difficult, right? That's part of the story here, is that leveraging stories and knowledge is difficult. It's very hard to do. Bringing together the people who have the knowledge on what they did here with the people who have the knowledge of what's going on in a country is difficult. And those are two different sets of knowledge. And I think one of the things that may be tremendously difficult to do and maybe a bridge too far would be to try and put all of that knowledge into one head. I don't think we need to do that. We need to find ways of coordinating and networking and bringing people together so that we can do that. I love the idea of creating a plurality of knowledge across donors. And I would also say, I think that I really do like the idea of trying to get people from the government as involved as possible, and that's obviously in the paper. I think that you're going to run into a lot of practical hurdles with that, just because it's costly, because people are busy, because, you know, Ava made a point to me at one point. She said, we don't have the biggest government in the world. You know, it's not as if we can just kind of take people from the statistical agency and they aren't going to leave a hole. They have jobs. And but you know, if we go where Adebayo was saying, and we say, well, let's create the law, let's create the story, let's go into the organizations and interview people, and let's create repositories of information, you don't need to take them out of their jobs to do that. The other thing that you could be thinking of doing is just having people from the government come on training weekends. You know, you guys do training events with people who work in your aid community. Well, those guys don't know anything about what's going on in the government. I mean, if they have people come in saying, this is what we did in the reform, this is how we engaged. On the political economy aspect, I actually think that this is the biggest area where people with experience doing stuff have the advantage over the people who are in the field working with counterparts, right? Because even when I'm working with counterparts in a developing country, as you rightfully say, they're the ones who have to really engage with the politics, right? They're the ones who, it's their country. I can observe, I can engage, I can cajole, I can advise. They're doing it. Now, I can analyze it, but they're engaging with it. Per has engaged with it in Sweden. And that's the kind of lesson that you want to put in front of your aid people to say, okay, when you're working with the budget director and you're asking the budget director to do this, this is an interpretation from my side as to how hard that is. This is what it's going to require, and this is how you should support them. So I think you can do that without taking people out of their jobs. The last comment, I love the idea of Team Sweden. It's a great idea. It's really interesting. And it gets to, in my head, the idea of kind of what are the overlaps between these communities that Pierre was saying. I would almost think of, you know, a circle of aid and development people from Sweden, a circle full of all the aid and development people in the multilaterals and other bilaterals, and then a circle of the reform people in Sweden. And the question I have in my head is, where's the overlap? And I think from the study and from the comments here, the overlap is more between the aid people internationally and the aid people in Sweden, much more than it is an overlap between the aid people in Sweden and the reform people in Sweden. And I think that that's where you then get the infection of what's going wrong in international development and all of the ticking the box approach to doing things, rather than the infection of this is actually how you behave politically, this is how you engage in a real way. And so really the challenge is to try and foster more of the engagement between those communities. And I think that that's a noble challenge. I think it's a really, really interesting challenge. And perhaps what you want to do is you want to start it in specific areas. You don't want to make it a government-wide thing. Maybe you want to do it in statistics. Maybe you want to do it in budget reform, but I thought this was a very interesting conversation. Thank you. Thank you for your thoughtful comments.
Thank you. I think we've already started sort of a general discussion here about the topic, and Mats and I thought that we might discuss along two lines. One, in fact, which is about reform. What is reform? What is successful reform? You have alluded to this, and what do we know about what is a successful reform? What are the elements, the factors that make for a successful reform that is also sustainable? Because, Matt, you mentioned that, you can have reform in appearance only. You will have the shell, but not the content. So do we have any good examples? There seems to be sort of a recipe for what you need to put in place, but are there any good examples where you've seen this happen? And do we have any good examples from Swedish Development Corporation, in particular, or in general? And also, we've talked about sort of South-South cooperation. Now it's been focused very much on sort of North donors. And what do we know about South-South cooperation? There are collaborative mechanisms in Africa, like CABRI and the Accountant General's initiative, and so on. And what do we know about how successful they are to engage in a peer process? How does this contribute? And then, we've seen, for example, with Sweden, we've had a long-term cooperation with audit, for example, which is sort of peer review. And does this mean that the audit institution as such gets strengthened? You will strengthen individual auditors in a partner country, but does this affect the institution and the status of the institution in a country? And I know we've had some recent research in Sweden looking particularly in the build-up of audit institutions and finding that somehow they follow the same international model, and they're not homegrown. So what do we know about these homegrown institutions? Do they exist, or is it just an idea out there? Well, these are some of the issues that we might discuss.
Maybe we start with this question, and then we can move on to the second one, which is more on the practical level. How do you do things practically? So... In a way, Matt, your argument has been that Sweden has something to contribute here. But is that because of Sweden is particularly well placed to do that? Or is that an entry point because Sweden is already involved with these big players and you need some entry points to change things, to do things differently? Or is it a genuine advantage that Sweden has? What's your take on that?
I think Sweden has an advantage because it has a story. To me, it's that simple. I think it has a story, and it also has relationships, right? It's in the field. It has a presence. It has a story. The problem is the story isn't coming out. And the story is, I don't think that everything is homegrown. I don't think everything is replicated. I think at the end of the day, there's a process of bricolage in an institutional reform, where you take ideas from the outside, you take ideas from the inside, and you create something that works for you. So there should be something similar in many of these reforms across countries, but there should also be something that's different, because it's not that you're creating everything anew. That's not how the world works, I don't believe. But I believe that the world works in that way, and I think that Sweden is an example of that. Uh-huh. And that story of how those things, how Sweden took ideas from other places, tried them out, in some cases changed them dramatically, in some cases didn't, built political constituencies to get them in place, I think that's a powerful and an important story. I would say that the story of how that was done in South Africa is as powerful and as important. And that's where the idea, I think, of creating this plurality of knowledge on how these things are done is excellent. And actually, when you create the plurality, what you do is you also make it very, very difficult for one to kind of get some hegemonic power, right? It's not about the Swedish story. It's about all of the stories. And it's about how all of the stories can empower people who are in the middle of the mess trying to make sense of it. And that's what I think is very useful and very powerful.
Would you agree to that, Adebayo, coming? Or would there be a difference between sort of the African experiences as towards the Northern European experiences?
No, I think there are advantages which a country like Sweden brings into the equation. Long-standing advantages. Not only the story of the success of the reform of the 90s in public finances, as detailed in the paper, long-term, a reform-minded community, pursuit of domestic consensus and compromise around the key reform agenda, experimentation, all of those ingredients are present there. What often happens where there is an external driver of reform in a developing country context is that a lot of these elements, even where they are acknowledged as important in principle, do not really play themselves out to allow for the kind of experimentation of the trial and error. And I will expand this to a much broader level to say that, in a sense, Matt, as I thought about the arguments you made about self-learning capacities, I thought we could broaden this, in fact, to the development experience more generally, in which countries that have been successful in driving reform, even where they tell a story, tend to tell a stylized story.
Correct.
A story that is so stylized that it actually doesn't correspond to the reality of what they went through. And that becomes then a codified mantra to say, you do A, B, and C on the basis of this stylization, and you get outcomes. And I think that is where the failure begins to come in.
Per, what is your comment on this? You mentioned that you wanted people to be involved or experienced in political circus. Is that the key, really? Because politicians sometimes say that, well, a researcher or an expert say that you need to do X, Y, Z, a number of things at the same time, but the politician says that, well, you start with this first. So there's some difference to the approach of it.
I believe it's mandatory that you have worked in the political sphere. Not to say that you have a former experience as a politician, but I mean civil servants in the Ministry of Finance or some other ministry. That's I believe is a precondition. When sending in someone who has got a PhD in economics in order to install a single treasury account in a foreign country, he or she will probably deliver, and there will come out a nice four-color report afterwards, and everything looks fine, but they will have no connection whatsoever to what's going on in that country. So I believe, even if there are enormous differences between countries like Sweden or Norway, on the other hand, and developing countries in Africa or Southern Asia, the problems I mentioned before, I mean the commons problem and the time consistency problem, those are generic.
Absolutely.
I mean they're universal to any community. They have to tackle those problems and develop political institutions to manage them. So that's a nice place to start. And I believe that whatever solution you are going to install will have to address those. I believe that any successful solution of the first will have to be based on the top-down approach to budgeting. You can't solve the commons problem without a top-down approach to budgeting. And as for the second, you can't solve the time consistency problem without a multi-annual framework. Yes. And then you can discuss the parameters. I mean, should we have 3, 4, or 5 years? How binding should it be? How comprehensive, etc. But those are mandatory components of any system of financial management anywhere in the world, I would claim. And that's a good starting point, because if you get somebody in with this experience, you could always start discussing with the local civil servants and political leaders. Okay, what does it look like in our countries? If we are going to bring about the public financial management reform, who's going to be our friend, who's going to be our foe in this particular country? Who are our allied, potential allies and so on? And that's where you can start from and develop. What will be the final outcome of this process is, cannot be predicted. But the basic building blocks are the same, I would say, whatever country you're talking about.
Pernilla, you're working at Statistics Sweden. We thought that we would put together a quite mixed panel, but you're all singing the same song here, more or less. But well, how to do this? You need a multitude of competence. You should put it together. I'm not hanging out your organization especially, but would that be possible within Statistics Sweden to find all these capacities, or how should one do this? How to go about
it? Well, as I reflected upon a little bit earlier, I mean, it takes really a lot of cooperation between different capacities and different expertise. So I think it's very difficult, what Per says, I think it's very difficult to find that competence in one person. I mean, those are not very many, those persons that have all these abilities. So therefore, you need the mix of experiences, and therefore you need a mix of people. And here I think there is a great potential, because I think that Sweden has that mix of people. If we talk about the statistics sphere, I mean, we've had a lot of very knowledgeable statisticians that know a lot about statistical systems and how you make things work, and how about the specific subject matter areas in different kind of statistical areas. And then we have the development experts. I mean, we have a very good development cooperation agency and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that is very knowledgeable. And then we need the knowledge about the national context and about the role that politics play. And there I think that we all actually, all these three parts, have a work to do in common. In terms of actually looking closer at how the different parts of a state bureaucracy work and what role politics play and so on and so forth. I think there is really where we all need more knowledge. Even it doesn't matter if we're technical experts or if we're development experts or others. I mean, we need to come together there in order to form a strong team of expertise. So I think, I mean, a government agency alone cannot do all this, of course, and that should not be the case either, I think. I don't think that is the point. It's more of a cooperation and sort of connecting these different expertise in a strong platform.
Adebayo, you've been working on these training modules for civil servants and policymakers. From that angle, what Matt says is that it's important to build these bridges. Is there something to learn from sort of the partners' side, how such bridges can be built? You mentioned also the need for contextual knowledge, that you need to know what country you're working in and all that. But coming from sort of a different angle, would there be anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, one of the key messages I've always tried to give in the context of the work we do with African civil servants, usually at senior leadership level in the civil service, including people who work on public finance management issues, essentially that even though, as Per says, there's what you can call a common denominator of issues, the way in which those issues are refracted into different contexts will also shape their capacity to engage with them effectively, even before a power analysis of context. At getting a TSA system in place, right, might be something that is a common denominator concern across the board. And you know what you probably need to do in order to get that process running. But translating it into a context like Senegal, universal as it may sound, will be different from its translation into a context like Sweden. Partly because the arrangement of the political system, the interplay of interest groups, the way in which interest groups interact with one another will differ from context to context. And this is one of the key messages we always try to send to those who participate in our programs, that the person who will drive reform in any context must be the best sociologist available, because you need to know your society so well as to be able to know what are the key levers to touch upon in order to be able to succeed with the reform agenda, to build the coalitions and to build the bridges. Perhaps you would also be a very good international relations expert, because then you can think of what external assistance you can leverage, from where and for what purposes. But most importantly is the sociological context that defines and shapes that context. What is it that makes a context like Mozambique tick? What is it that makes a context like Senegal tick? And what should you be putting your finger upon in a reform agenda in order to change behavior or in order to change outcomes? And thereafter, one can begin to look at the tools that are available for doing this more effectively.
Well, I don't know who's going to answer this, but I mean, it was claimed that now with the development cooperation now being much more streamlined in a sense, I mean, would there be openings then for a donor like Sweden to say, no, we want to change tack here when it comes to capacity development and to reform in certain areas?
I want to just get onto this political thing. One of the things I struggle with at Harvard is how do I train our students? Because I need to train them in this, right? And for a long time, we focused on training them to do political economy analysis, where they would do stakeholder analysis. They would look at, you know, trying to do an analysis of what makes people tick. And at the end of the day, I think we came to a conclusion that we you can't do that. You can't analyze what makes people tick. You need to know how to engage with politics and learn what is making people tick as you move, right? Again, I think that's one of the things that people who've been in a reform process and who've been through the process and come on the other side, they know how to do that, which is why I think also that tacit experience is huge. Does Sweden have opportunities? I think absolutely. I think it's interesting to me that Sweden is working on the internal audit stuff in this way in the countries where we looked at. When I worked in this area, internal audit wasn't the most the most fought over area in public financial management, and a lot of the donors didn't, you know, the bigger donors didn't really want to get involved in internal audit. I think that is changing a little bit, but certainly a decade ago, it just wasn't the sexiest place to be, which I think means that, you know, people leave it alone. Which means that there are opportunities for you to engage in a more unfettered manner than other places. I think if you want to work on straight out budget reform or treasury reform, you're going to run into the ticking the box approach, and that's going to be very difficult. But I do think there are areas in my own work doing development differently. We work in a bunch of countries, and we try to find, you know, what we would call the back alleys of development, all of the areas where the donors have said enough, we don't want anything to do with those people. So in Mozambique, we worked in justice because even the Swedes had left. Everyone had said, we don't want to go there, the corruption is terrible, everything. But they had a minister who had some serious problems and said, I need to do something. So the scope for doing something a little out of the ordinary was very high. We're working in Albania in just about every area, and most of the donors have left. So I think that there are opportunities, but you need to almost look for those opportunities, and sometimes it might be in smaller areas. And I think then you can build the reputation as being a listening donor, as being a donor that brings stories and that brings experienced people. And I think that that can then perhaps even infect the other donors in the way that they do their business.